Welcome to Words on a Wire. This is Tim Hernandez, and today we will be speaking with the wonderful poet based out of Minnesota, Jennifer Kwan Dobbs, about her latest collection of poetry entitled Interrogation Room. Jennifer is just an amazing poet, a brilliant professor there at St. Olaf College in Minnesota, who I had the pleasure of meeting back in 2011, and through a mutual friend of ours, poet Lee Herrick, and we were at a writer's conference, and immediately we hit it off, and all three of us began talking about how one day we've all kind of in our own ways honor our ancestors, and all of a sudden that led to a fantastic conversation about one day we will all have white hair and we'll do a reading together. And so, needless to say, we've stayed friends ever since. And I followed her work, and so I was really excited when she came out with this brand new book, Interrogation Room. And her new book has received such wonderful blurbs and accolades, and I want to read to you from the back of the book by Carol Musk Dukes. She writes, "These poems are a profound cordon sanitaire space in the consciousness of a poet who is interrogating her own lost history, her stolen past, most dramatically enacted in her devoted search for her Korean birth mother. Dobbs crosses hidden frontiers of the self as she overcomes restricted travel, restricted speech, and a divided country. Her unredacted revelations lead to extraordinary discoveries." And that is coming up right now in Words on a Wire. Jennifer Kwan Dobbs is the author of Paper Pavilions and Interrogation Room, as well as a chapbook, Notes from a Missing Person. She is also the recipient of grants from the Dazon Foundation, the Minnesota State Arts Board, among many others, and she's the Associate Professor of Creative Writing and Program Director of Race and Ethnic Studies at St. Olaf College. She lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. Jennifer Kwan Dobbs, welcome to Words on a Wire, my friend.
Oh, thanks so much, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's so great to finally hear your voice after many years since the last time we shared the company of one another there. I think it was there in Minnesota in 2011, right?
I think it was. I think it was actually during AWP.
That's right. Well, that's where we first met, was at AWP, I think in DC that year. And then like later, I want to say around 2011 in the winter time or something, we came out to St. Olaf where you teach, and we did a reading, myself and Lee Herrick, and we all hung out. And it was a wonderful time, but that was so long ago. Wow, that's crazy. It's 7 years.
I know. But I feel like, you know, with poets who I adore and whose work I really admire, I feel like, you know, it hasn't really been that long, even though it has been.
That's true. I know. It's like we're always kind of keeping tabs on one another. And I know, you know, since your last book, Paper Pavilion, which I first came aware of in 2011 when we met, you know, that book just blew me away. And then obviously I got to sit down and we got to chat and get to know each other a little more. And, you know, just kind of learning who you are and your family and your own life experiences. You know, I knew that we were instant friends, and that you had in me a longtime fan of your writing. So I was really excited about your new book, Interrogation Room.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, congratulations on it.
Yeah. This book actually took me 10 years to write. It was a book that just needed a long time to gestate, as it were.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm so delighted that it's out in the world. So thanks so much for having me here to talk about it.
Absolutely. That's one of the things I wanted to ask you, because I would gather that it took at least 10 years to put together because of the extensive amount of research that went into this book and revision, I would imagine. And just, you know, it's such a rich, complex, layered collection of poetry that I can't see it taking any less than that amount of time. And testament, obviously, to your own poetic prowess. But, you know, I guess I kind of, before we had you on here, I described to our listeners your book from reading from some of the blurbs in the back. But how would you, in your own words, describe this book for our listeners?
I'd say that this book, you know, like I mentioned earlier, it took me 10 years to write. And I'd say that this book had to work with ways in which the ongoing war in Korea has been internalized in my particular imagination. So it was a matter of confronting laws that I had internalized, that I hadn't even known, you know, had silenced me. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking in particular about the national security law in South Korea. Mm-hmm. There's, I think, this cliche where one imagines, you know, they have to write what they know. But in my particular case, I've always been grasping after what it is that blocks me from knowing more.
Right.
And in this particular case with the national security law, it was passed shortly before the Jeju Uprising in South Korea, mm-hmm. and it criminalizes contact between North Korea and South Korea.
Right.
And trying to write through this national security law, it was a way of acknowledging how I've, you know, developed an imagination that is militarized, in particular by South Korean and U.S. militarism,
mm-hmm.
ways in which, in thinking about my positionality as a Korean adoptee, I've accepted the fact that I'm outside of the Korean diasporic narrative, and I'm just sort of building my own separate identity. But I no longer believe that. I think
instead,
it's about tackling that national security law and recognizing that there are ways in which we internalize ongoing war.
Right. Yeah, you know, and that's interesting that, you know, that you would have at one point felt that way, that you were outside of that narrative, the Korean diasporic narrative. And, you know, I wouldn't have guessed that about you and your experience. In fact, I think it's very much an extension of that narrative. But, you know, you also mentioned this idea of militarized imagination, which is really, that's just a fantastic coupling of words there to describe. I think even the kind of overall tone of this collection of poetry does have a kind of a militarized imagination. There are, you know, for the listener who can't, you know, flip through the book like I can here, you know, there are lots of areas or poems that contain a sense of restriction, you know, or blacking out or canceling out of language. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure, definitely. You know, I think that the dominant narrative about transnational adoption is that the Korean adoptee, or, you know, the adoptee who's coming from a sending country, is a blank slate. You know, they're arriving completely disconnected from the country of origin, and their identities then become their adoptive family's identities.
Yeah.
But, you know, rather than fixating on identity, I'm really interested in ways in which there are social forces that are pushing the person out of the sending country. Although the Korean War may not be front and center, it is an ongoing war that is at least 70 years old at this point.
Right.
And it is in particular ways in which South Korean identity is very much shaped by the fact that South Koreans are not allowed to be in touch with their North Korean relatives, even though there are hundreds of thousands of relatives in the North. As a Korean adoptee, for me to imagine that I have family in the North.
Yeah.
And to think about ways in which I've, you know, through this militarized technology of language making, for example, rather than utilizing the term Northern Korea rather than North Korea, to imagine Korea as a peninsula within which my English has been an assimilating technology, so that when I do speak Korean, I sound like a child.
Wow.
I'm always sort of frozen, always already in this position of being a child, in this disempowered position. You know, and sort of grappling with those matters, that's where I wanted to begin in writing some poems.
Wow.
The last thing I'll say, too, related to this is part of the reason why it took 10 years was because I started out with a manuscript that was then completely turned on its head by the fact that I began studying Korean shortly after I reunited with my Korean family.
Right.
And that's when, you know, you're moving your mouth in ways that you're unaccustomed to. You begin to tackle, right, like how there's militarism tied up in your muscles, and you start to unlock all that body memory.
That's right. That's absolutely
really
right.
Astonishing.
Yeah. Well, you know, myself as a third and fourth generation Chicano in the United States, you know, more recently as an adult now, in the last several years, having a sort of intention now, or being intentional about learning Spanish again, you know, it's, you know, when you're absolutely right, the moment we start to shape our mouth, the moment we start to form new muscle memory, you know, there are within us, the DNA starts to, like, there are these, like, sort of these embers that, and within our DNA that start to reignite again. And, you know, I'm discovering that now. And then only recently, a few years ago, took a trip for the first time into central Mexico, you know, beyond the fronteras here. And with that, coupled with learning language, suddenly it was almost like a returning home to a space that I've been so removed from for generations, you know. And you're absolutely, you know, would you mind just kicking us off with one of these poems so that way our listeners can hear what we're discussing?
Sure. So this particular poem is called Northern Korea Postcard.
Can you tell me what page that's on? I'm sorry.
Sure, it's on page 26.
Okay.
And I wanted to write some poems that were situated in the North, but in a way in which I'm remapping the imagination mm-hmm. of the reader to pierce through that militarism, which I think is tied up in nationalism, and instead to imagine that they're moving in northern Korea.
Right.
It's a northern Korea postcard driving in South Gwanghae province. But Professor Jung explains a poet should work with farmers to write of harvest. Recall 160 kilometers away, Professor Kim said there's no poetry in the north. Both answers seem compelled by law, concealing a revolver aimed at the senses, alert to an intruding thought. What of you, who dwells at the border, adopted by all four directions? The grass recovers as its own. It roots in landmines, feeds ghosts who owe allegiance, only to where they're buried. You're a fleeting image to these cornfields that don't know you, or forcibly removed from the south, that transgress the border like a tunneling army turns and overturns every stone to unlock forbidden ground.
Hmm. And if you are just tuning into Words on a Wire, we are speaking with poet Jennifer Kwan Dobbs, who is on the phone with us from her home in Minnesota. And we're talking about her new collection of poetry, Interrogation Room. And, you know, it's funny that I refer to this as a collection of poetry because it almost doesn't seem an adequate label for what's contained inside this book. You know, is that how you would refer to it? Or, you know, I don't know, it's kind of a narrative in fragments, or, I mean, is that what you refer to this as, a collection of poetry? I know it sounds like a strange question,
I appreciate your...
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Yeah, I appreciate your question, Tim, because I think you're right. It's not a collection, maybe in the conventional sense of that word, where we think about poems held together thematically and that create an arc of experience.
Right.
Instead, you know, I think these poems are working more as like a site of excavation, and that they're highly intertextual with the way they're working with different kinds of documents and images that are part of a larger historical record that has been rendered invisible. I guess the other thing that I would say, too, is the way in which I'm juxtaposing and breaking genre at the same time with these collisions with, you know, different forms of documentation, kind of make this more like a, how to put it, like a kind of way of moving across space.
Right.
So it's not really about, you know, a thematic collection, but more about creating spaces, I would argue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It is a text of space. And, you know, because even right in the center of the book, on the book's spine, you have this longer prose notes from a missing person, you know, in the middle of all that. And I'm glad you mentioned the intertextuality of this book because, you know, there's something even more recently I've started to notice that there's a kind of a contemporary national kind of a shift or a trend toward including, you know, more of this kind of official records and documents and research. I think of, you know, the poet Lely Long Soldier's fantastic book, Whereas, and Sun Young Shin as well, her fantastic recent book as well. And you know, and this is more and more I'm seeing this. Why do you feel like we are kind of, or there is a trend maybe, you know, moving toward this intertextuality of including official records? What's your assessment of that?
Right. That's a great question. I think that for Indigenous and poets of color, that there is always this question related to power. Ways in which power in the form of white supremacy, silver colonialism, in the case of the collection, some of the collections that you've mentioned, which now that I'm speaking about genre, I think to myself, maybe that's not the word. Maybe there's a different kind of word that we need to be inventing, to grapple with the issues that you're raising here. But let me just say, maybe books for now. Ways in which the book is being reinvented by these writers to confront the power of these, I don't know, regimes, state apparatuses, racial projects that have made the book for us a matter of grappling with the technologies that the book has been a means of promoting, of shaping in our own experiences from our community locations, so that the book itself is an ambivalent thing Right. If that makes sense. Like, grammar is ambivalent.
Right.
Language as a means of assimilation and border making is ambivalent.
That's right. In a very intentionally subversive way, using the language of officialness, to reconsider, for us to reconsider and reexamine what exactly is at work here.
Yes, yes.
And tell me a little bit about, and this is kind of me just geeking out here and maybe a little more esoteric, but tell me a little, because I'm always interested. You said it took about 10 years, but can you tell me a little bit about, your own research process? Like, are you led instinctually? I would align myself more with that. I kind of am more of an instinctual researcher, or do you, is there some kind of, method that you follow? How do you know what you're after and how do you go about researching?
I think in my particular case, I really view myself as an interdisciplinary writer. I don't think that research, serves like tertiary to the poetic process. Mm-hmm. At least in my particular case, when I'm navigating the forms I've received and forms that I long to create because I can't find a way of writing otherwise,
right.
Research becomes a means for me to confront, again, those structures of language mm-hmm. embedded in the officialness of documents
or
absences of language that are prohibiting me from speaking. Research becomes a way of uncovering those things and then looking at them as found forms that I have been carrying within me always without knowing it necessarily.
Right. Yes.
So, in other words, an absence is actually, without getting too abstract here, an absence is actually a made thing. So, for example, in the research that I did for Interrogation Room, it drew from my work from working with the Korea Policy Institute as a fellow, whereby I was doing research on North Korean adoption. It drew from my work also as an advocate for transnational Korean adoptees tied to birth searches. So what were ways in which I was directly confronting these absences that were made by, the national security law, whereby North Korea is this big absence in our imagination. We don't know what's happening there, supposedly. There's no light there.
Right,
who knows
what's
going on? Like, that's completely manufactured. And then secondly, too, with the ways in which these adoption papers are shaped, they're purposefully made in order to hide and obscure origins.
Right.
So research becomes a way of finding those structures of power and then breaking them to create forms that can pierce through and create ways of feeling and thinking that put us in touch with whatever the structures of power have been concealing all along and rendering as natural those concealments.
Absolutely. And, maybe now is the time actually to ask you to share another poem with us, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure, sure. So I'm just going to read an excerpt from this poem, How to Eat Your Love.
Yes.
It's a longer poem. It's on page 87. Right. I'm going to read up to 89.
I love that poem.
But it's a poem I wrote for Emma, which means mother in Korean, and it also incorporates some Korean language. How to Eat Your Love. And it begins with a dedication, Uri Emma Ege, which means for Emma. In your version, I come back deformed, a ghost turned backward, bare feet, decayed teeth, raiding our ancestors' tombs, meat stripped, mouse bones thrown at your door. So you bow your head, stabbed at the boiling red with white knuckles of young radish as I lick the lock unable to cross. A rope of chili peppers announcing your son's birth. The eldest I was a secret, vessel of your rage, all digestion. I clenched and uncoiled across your pelvis, seizing the greasy bits you scraped portion by the textile factory's canteen. The machines cranked and thrust, spitting they fingered every orifice, looped into fresh skein a dark thread. You cursed, if only it would slide out. For whom do I interpret this fury? Forgive me, you say. I was poor, alone. And the economic miracle, we were all raw, material, orphaned to such hard currency like Jolado girls groomed for kissing tours, now birth, mothers to the missing, crated overseas to military allies. The North reports of a child sold to a New York circus. Let me see my father, Kim Il-sung, she pleads. From the cage, of hook-nosed American greed. I don't believe that. My colleague Cho translated the adopted boy, calling, "What is she? Dola Duseo. Uncle, help me go home," to the white parents carrying him into the Texas Denny's. Eat to remember, to forget each other, eat the charred flesh, lettuce parcels of conscripted uncles, night delivered from Vietnam, shrouded in flags. Open your mouth to the unreliable ones, hidden in Russian snow, Kemptown princes, dust of the streets, mixed and nameless. They searched restaurant scraps as kin to you, a farm girl squatting to push out contaminants, making you sick. Clogged toilet shared by 8 families, slabbed on the dawn floor, all that waste, the factory churned into the river, somehow clean blood out of your best cotton dress.
And if you're just tuning in to Words on a Wire, that is the voice of poet Jennifer Kwan Dobbs reading from her latest collection titled Interrogation Room, and that's out with White Pine Press. You know, one of the other things about this book, Jennifer, too, is that, you know, and what made me think of this actually is that you were speaking Korean within this poem, you know, mm-hmm. that the poem obviously has multiple languages in here, not just the language of your ancestry, but also English and also, but also the language of official documents and records. And, you know, I think of that this book is very textured also in that way. Your book also contains images that obviously our listeners can't see, but I'm flipping through the book here and I, you know, you have photos as well as a very touching, actually, handwritten letter. And so, you know, why this need to include a kind of a textured a book?
So one of the ways in which this book is moving is toward a place of reunification. Mm-hmm. We talked earlier about how it's sort of a book of space. And I would say one of those spaces is one of hope, which is a place where all kinds of Korean can be spoken, including diaspora Korean. And some of the language in here, too, is drawing from the sensibility of Northern Korean Korean. So, for example, the poem Bungap Sumnida, that refers to the title of a North Korean reunification song, which, you know, if it's okay to maybe sing a quick line of it, it's Dongpo Yoreben, Hyeongjae Yoreben, which is basically
it's basically
the first few measures of nice to meet you, 반갑습니다, which North Korea is singing to South Korea. It's so nice to meet you, you know, comrades, fellow Koreans. So I include that kind of Korean along with, you know, the handwritten note, like you said, 의리엄에 에게 미안해요, 나는 실패했습니다. You know, that particular letter, it's actually a poorly written letter in that a native speaker of Korean will read this and just see all these errors in it.
Right.
I even have a crossed out phrase in there where I've corrected myself. And I thought it was important in terms of imagining a space of hope, of reunification, where someday we will be Northern and Southern Korean and all of the diaspora will be able to come together too, that it wasn't about hiding Korean linguistic differences, but rather to acknowledge that it has to be through the mistaken Korean, the incorrect so-called Korean, the Korean that sounds like you're a baby speaking, which my Korean definitely sounds like. It has to be in all these ways that the languages that are in our bodies when we're trying to communicate with each other make present, you know, those flaws, those fractures.
Yeah.
It's not about smoothing them out. It's about how they can all be together in one space.
Right. And we are running out of time, as my producer points out. And gosh, I have so many questions still for you. But you know what? I don't want to run out of time before you get a chance to read a final poem. So would you mind reading a poem for us?
Sure, sure. Maybe I'll just close with the last poem in the collection, The Telling.
Mm-hmm, please.
Again, you know, thinking about a moment in time in the future where we will be able to be together, and even moments that are, you know, tentative, whereby we're able to be together. I think sometimes in a poem, you know, is an act of language and intimacy that, you know, maybe we can stage those moments in a poem in order to think about how we can also embody them in other ways. So this poem is called The Telling. It's an epigraph from Christine Ahn. We were anxiously waiting for Koreans in the north, and just over the crest of the horizon, a light glowed, is a group of people holding candles waiting down the river. In your dream, the fathers come from four directions, gowned in dawn. They carry the broken, sons from the grassy banks, and descend to submerge waist high in the center, where the law cannot force them to forget or to remember the joy of the cool water, how the riverbed pillows their scabbed feet, the pleasure of belonging to no nation. They congregate as one, peace made from the male parts, disarmed and unarmored. As the currents wash over, their tenderest flesh, shocked by the gentle sway, as a softening wells inside their groins and chests, they surrender to how good it feels to surrender. And you depart upriver, a Korean woman testing the surreal death worlds others invent about our northern relatives whom they've never met, or who infiltrate the north disguised as teachers weaponizing their gifts to smuggle out the true story that is always the same story, cooking shut inside an unceasing war, horse thrashed into a blind courier. But you, who can see and hear, attend to the dream that shows its hands, that fragile moment between you and Park Bong-ji. We went to be seen as human. Tell them we are human, she said. Tell them the dream of the grandmother who stirs a brass pot over a campfire and ladles a dark substance into the children's pails to carry over a mountain. Tell them the women of many nations, quilted cloth from many nations and guest song. Tell of their song, we are one, we are one. Tell them she, whose hand shrapnel severed, steadied the bright fabric as the women sewed, even though South Koreans phoned in, threats of arrest and acid thrown on the women's faces, if they crossed the DMZ of the Southerners' imaginations. Tell them there is only the telling that can create a home, no matter how unseen or preposterous, that originates as a murky sludge, an elemental soup on the tongue and cared for over a hearth that could nourish us again if we tell ourselves, sister and brother, together we want to live.
And that is the voice of poet Jennifer Kwan Dobbs reading from her latest collection, Interrogation Room, out with White Pine Press. You want to be sure to pick that up. Jennifer, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you again, my friend.
Oh, thank you, Tim. Such an honor.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and congratulations, and good luck with this book.
I'm so appreciated, Tim.
Great.
Take care.
You too. And that wraps it up for today's edition of Words on a Wire. We'd like to thank our very special guest, poet Jennifer Kwan Dobbs, talking to us all the way from Minnesota. Also like to thank our wonderful producer back there, Stefania, so much for all the magic and wizardry you do back there. That wraps it up. We'll see you next week, same time, same place, KTEP 88.5 FM.